Last week, in a zoo in Cincinnati, in the USA, a child, I think 3 years old, while his parents weren't supervising him, wandered into an enclave where lowland silverback gorillas were kept, and, at least according to many onlookers, was seriously threatened by that gorilla. And it's become an internet viral sensation. At certain stages, the gorilla appeared to be protecting the child, but at other stages became violent, and the unique force and power and strength of this 450-pound gorilla was placing this child's life in jeopardy. The custodians and management of the zoo reckoned that tranquilizing the gorilla would be insufficient, that it would take too much time, and in the duration between shooting this gorilla with a tranquilizer gun and having the tranquilizing effect occur, the child's life would not just remain in danger but be placed in even greater danger. The gorilla may be adversely affected by the tranquilizer shot. So they took the decision to neutralize the gorilla on behalf of saving the life of the child. Of course, this story has gone viral, has evoked a firestorm of discussion, some of it technical. From the video footage which was captured, was the gorilla actually threatening and imperiling the child, or as has occurred in some previous cases, precedents, where gorillas have been very protective of little children who wandered into their cages or their enclaves? The professional assessment whether tranquilizing the animal was feasible, that has been called into question. And those are obviously important questions to raise, as well as other questions peripherally related to the safety measures taken by the zoo and the degree of supervision expected of a parent while visiting zoos with children and preventing them from wandering into dangerous situations. But there's one question that has at least implicitly been voiced, and it's a very disappointing question, and thank God many voices of reason have responded to that question. And assuming the situation as it is presented to us, that it's the life of a gorilla versus the life of a human being, was it a moral decision to rescue the life of an endangered human being who had even encroached on the gorilla's area of residence or his zone by taking the life of a gorilla? And, of course, from a Jewish perspective, there's only one answer. From a Jewish perspective, pikuach nefesh is docha kala Torah kula. It's the highest value, and we violate even Isur Yom Kippur to save a human life. Certainly something which may not even be Asur Min HaTara. Tzar Balei Chaim, it's not clear whether it's Asur Min HaTara, Asur Min Drabban. It's also not clear whether killing an animal is in violation of Tzar Balei Chaim, especially if the taking of that animal's life is performed painlessly and rapidly. And that's how every God-fearing, Orthodox-practicing Jew processes a question based on the halachic parameters. And of course, many have written about it, many who don't operate within the orbit of halacha have raised moral voices in support of saving the life of a human being. Others have opposed this, and obviously we staunchly oppose their opposition. We staunchly discredit any attempt to create equality between a human life and a non-human life. That's not the purpose of this conversation. Very often in life, we ask a secondary question, but we don't question the premise that led to that question. And if we explore the premise of our questions, we can uncover assumptions and presumptions we make which deserve to be questioned and challenged. And we can trace how those assumptions, which may not be correct or accurate or morally driven, manifest themselves in other areas of our lives beyond the Cincinnati Zoo and the question of Harambe, the gorilla, who was neutralized on behalf of saving this child's life. Hopefully very few of us will find ourselves in that situation, but the premise of these questions itself deserves to be questioned, and by questioning that premise, we may uncover a certain dangerous culture creep and values which should themselves be discredited. or disqualified. The Gemara is very aware of this. The Gemara endlessly asks, Mahu Detema, what were we thinking? Why do we need a Gemara or a Pasuk to teach us the Halacha when it should be obvious? And then the Gemara tells us that maybe it isn't obvious, maybe it's a contrary logic. Sometimes when that contrary logic, which is being rejected by the Gemara's conclusion, seems so queer and so peculiar, the Gemara actually questions in a more aggressive tone, Vidakarila Maikarila, what was the Gemara even thinking? What was the Pasuk even thinking that it spent time and energy and words and verbiage to conclude differently? And I think that that phraseology is very much necessary. Why is this even a question? Why have close to 500,000 people signed the petition, Justice for Harambe? Although I read the petition, and the wording of the petition was primarily focused on investigating the parents and their responsibility to guard and safeguard their children. The accusations and the assumptions seemed very exaggerated, as if the fact that this child wandered into the guerrilla enclave may indicate general parental malfunction and neglect, which they found hard to process. A moment of indiscretion or distraction could lead to child, and we all know having children at a zoo is a difficult situation to contain. But certainly the title of the petition, Justice for Harambe, and the fact that the petition seems to be spearheaded by animal rights activists, and the fact that there were vigils held outside of the zoo by animal rights activists, makes us question, how did we get to a stage of animal rights? And is that a phrase that we can easily let pass, at least in the way it's being presented and processed by modern society? To me, that's the deeper question, not whether Harambe should be tranquilized or Harambe should be neutralized to save a child, but why is this even a question? And where do these uncertainties stem from, or these challenges? And more importantly, how do they express themselves in other aspects of our lives? I think the concept of animal rights has emanated from a society that is obsessed with human rights, and in many ways justifiably so. After a millennia of human suffering, whole-scale human suffering, man drew himself from the muck and mediocrity of the medieval period and reformed his world of culture, of science, of technology, but most dramatically reformed the political mechanisms by which he governs large-scale nations. And the democratic era was a bold announcement for humanity in America and in France in the latter part of the 18th century, playing off of the seeds of democracy that had been germinating to various degrees in the British Empire for close to 600 years, 500 years. And that wave of democracy swept over much of the continent in the ensuing two centuries, in the 19th century and the 20th century, in partial, but certainly far beyond the borders of the United States and France. And democracy didn't just reorganize the system of government from totalitarian regime, from divinely appointed kings, to publicly elected through representation, but it also asserted the rights of man: life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and property, life, liberty, and equality. And it entrusted the state with protecting those rights. And the state, through all arms and organs of its governance, must protect human rights, civil liberties, against the abuse of either institutionalized exploitation, exploiting people's rights through large-scale organizations or governments, or even individual exploitation. And the downside of such a society is that we've become very litigious. We're constantly prosecuting others who we feel have compromised our rights, and sometimes it could become a bit preposterous. But ultimately, we've created a society which values the rights of man. But something happened. We lost sight of the fact that human rights, the rights of man, are not an end unto themselves. Man's goal is not to protect, to enjoy, and to secure rights. That is not a moral way to lead life. What do I deserve? And how can I protect my deserved rights, or in Hebrew, my zechuyot? Man is placed on this world to perform duty. In a religious context, those are duties to God, to people, to Jewish history, to land. Even stripped of its religious context, it could be articulated in a purely moral sense. Duties to other human beings, duties to higher moral callings. When his rights are compromised or suspended or trampled, man becomes inhibited from attending to those duties. He doesn't enjoy freedom, liberty of movement, freedom of ambition, property, which is the bulwark of human welfare, and he is disempowered from fully expressing his potential in the performance of duty. So ultimately, the preservation and protection of human rights is a moral calling to enable man to live a life of duty and a higher calling. But at some point, we lost that sense of rights as a means, and we have converted rights into an end unto themselves. As part of our deification of democracy, we've become so intoxicated because we're so grateful for democracy that we've allowed the pursuit of rights to cloud and to obscure our moral clarity, our moral sensibility. And we've lost that sense of duty. And I think that loss is obvious to many who live in a society obsessed with consumption, self-interest, self-absorption, self-improvement, blinded very often to higher callings of duty, responsibility, again, either in a religious context or any moral, communal context. And one of the collateral effects of this obsession with rights, severed, independent of duty, is extending rights to animals. If human beings have rights, shouldn't animals have rights as well? Well, animals don't live lives of duty. And if they don't live lives of duty, are their rights meant to be protected? Do they have rights? If rights are really meant to facilitate higher calling. Animals live free, unencumbered. They're driven purely by instinct to procreate, to feed, to protect themselves. Even animals that exhibit higher forms of social and communal behavior and communication. It isn't in the service of any higher moral duty. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created resplendent, glorious world of nature, which we describe in various Prakim of Tehillim. Baruch Hashem on Rosh Chodesh. This coming Tuesday, we'll describe it in Baruch Hinafshis Hashem, a fresco of the different parts of nature, many of which include the animal kingdom. But there's no higher agenda for animals. There's no reward or punishment for animals. Animals don't possess a divine image or freedom of choice. And that service of duty doesn't exist. And if duty doesn't exist, then rights don't exist either. It doesn't mean that when human beings are negligent in their duty, they abdicate their rights. Human beings, as a species, in general, generically, are creatures of duty, and therefore their rights are to be protected. Animals are not. And I think this is the question beneath the question, not whether Harambe's rights were violated. How did we get to a stage that we're discussing animal rights, that we have activists on behalf of animal rights? That language is offensive. That language is fraudulent. But it stems from a greater danger, a society which is pivoted on rights, not on duties. I should also relate to two subsidiary parts of this conversation, related but independent. Indeed, in halacha, Tzar Baalei Chaim is a very compelling constraint. But even though it refers to Tsar Ba'alei Chaim, it's unclear if the aversion to causing unnecessary pain to animals is because they feel pain in the manner that human beings wince or feel psychological suffering. That in and of itself is a modern debate amongst modern thinkers, clinicians, doctors, philosophers. Pain requires memory and anticipation. If a person feels a sharp pinch, but it lasts only for a second, you're not going to feel pain. It'll be more likened to the needles you feel when your foot falls asleep. Pain is something that, as we say, is painful because it has a duration. We remember the pain we felt 10 seconds ago, and we loop that together to the pain we're feeling now, and we anticipate that that pain will continue, which is why very often, if you know the pain will subside imminently, it's no longer painful in the moment. If animals don't experience the duration of memory, do they really feel pain? That's an interesting question that's being probed by modern scientists. Even if animals don't feel pain, Tsar Ba'alei Chaim is driven primarily by conditioning human beings to act mercifully rather than cruelly and with brutality. And as we know so often, in the pathological sense, brutality to animals very quickly escalates to brutality to other human beings. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to act noble, not vulgar, refined, not uncouth. And of course, this is part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's masterpiece, part of his world. We don't want to trample or tamper upon that world or vandalize it. So even if animals don't feel pain, Tsar Ba'alei Chaim, either if it's rabbinic or min ha-Torah, demands that we feed our animals first and not cause them undue pain. Rivka was lauded for feeding Eliezer's animals. But it doesn't stem from the rights that an animal has which are being abused in the same way that a woman has rights in a marriage or an eved has rights in a relationship or in any halachic interaction. A tovea has rights or a nitva has rights. Animals don't possess rights. They may possess pain. They may not possess pain. Either way, a person is enjoined and obligated to avoid brutal activity which vandalizes HaKadosh Baruch Hu's masterpiece. And finally, part of the conversation surrounding Harambe and this, I wouldn't call it a tragedy. When I read those words, I find that word means a little harsh. It's unfortunate. It's disappointing. But I don't imagine that if you were driving, when I drive on the West Bank, so very often you have to be careful for goats and sheep, which pass, as I'm sure you've seen the pictures and probably have driven. Or if you drive and you hit a jackal or a fox or a cat or a dog, or I certainly would try to avoid it. I would slam on the brakes if I saw it. I'd feel sad and disappointed if I weren't. But I can't imagine coming home at night after hitting a dog and calling it a tragedy. It may be a tragedy if that dog was a pet of someone else and that person had invested emotions in that dog, and therefore that person's emotions at this point would be tragically altered and negatively impacted. But that just poses a different question, which I won't discuss in this conversation, and that is, how deeply do we invest emotions in creatures that provide affection and acts of affection but don't have a soul in the classic sense? And how deeply do we engage? They don't have a soul. They have personality traits. They respond in different ways. Their activities evoke moods within human beings, and they seem to behave in ways that are parallel to our moods, but they don't possess freedom of decision. They don't possess a divine image. They don't possess the classic human emotions. But that's a larger conversation about a society and how it values its pets. And it's much more complex and nuanced than this conversation. But the word tragedy, in part, has been applied to this event, in part because I believe he was a silverback gorilla of an endangered species. I think there were only 175,000 still living. And in the environment of preserving and repopulating endangered species, his death is taken as more severe and more worrisome than an accidental or preventative caused death of another animal, let's say let's say a lion that isn't endangered had been threatening a human being and they shot the lion, I'm not sure you would have heard this public outcry. And then raises a related question. What is the Jewish view on endangered species and preserving endangered species? And without question, as Rav Lichtenstein would so often quote, we are custodians of this world. It is our responsibility, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Adam, li'ovda u'lishamra. And that phrase, to develop this world, but to protect and preserve it, even though it's understood by Chazal to refer to spiritual activity as well, mitzvos and maisim tovim, at the base level, at the literal level, it means to channel and marshal the immense force and potential of this planet and of this universe, but to behave in a responsible fashion. And to make sure, through normal human decisions, calibration, moderation, not to despoil, not to wantonly abuse nature. And perhaps it doesn't just speak to abusing nature, exploiting nature, stripping nature of its nutrients, recklessly burning, recklessly wasting, experiences such as Baal Tashchis, but it could, I'm not sure it does, but it could also refer to overfishing and overhunting. Although it's not entirely clear that if that fishing and hunting is performed on behalf of human welfare, that it would entail a violation of li'ovda l'shamra. And to the degree that we live in a world which is more sensitive to the delicate ecological balance of our ecosystem, and the disappearance of a particular species may have a domino effect on the entire food chain. So that's knowledge which wasn't available to earlier generations. And with that knowledge, we have to act responsibly within that context as well. So it's not just a prohibition against reckless vandalism of nature, but also keeping that ecosystem in general in effect and in its proper balance in general, through human, as we call it, hishtadlus, through human logical and responsible behavior. But if we sense that a species is becoming endangered, should it cause the type of shock and worry, the type of response and investment that we witness in the modern era in the post-Darwinian world? Does it belie a lack of recognition of a pasuk we say from Tehillim every Friday night, Av Tikon Tevel Baltimot? Since that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a stable world and solidified and stabilized that world in his treaty with Noach in the end of Parshas Noach, in which he promised him that the world would no longer be torn asunder, would no longer undergo the apocalyptic wholesale destruction. And how much of modern man, now that man has armed himself to be capable of nuclear apocalypse, how much of modern man and modern man's thought process is invested in worrying about and averting an apocalypse? It's a very, very delicate balance, because as I said before, we're not meant to be wanton and unrestrained and irresponsible in our use of nature. And to the degree that we're custodians and we've been given greater tools with greater precision to supervise the stability and the perpetuity of this world, we should employ them. But this attitude that the world is endangered and is facing ecological crisis and disaster without accommodating space for faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and letting that calibrate and moderate the actions we take and the efforts we invest, I think some of that is a little bit imbalanced in the treatment of this event. To call it unfortunate, certainly. If we could save a life without that life of an animal, without question. But to discuss this as a tragedy because a silverback gorilla of the 175,000 that still roam the earth, and despite all the best efforts of our zoos and all the nature organizations to try to repopulate, and so that on its own it could be seen as a favorable, important agenda, but to call it a tragedy, I think, is a word that's too radical, too extreme, and too insensitive to that very delicate balance between faith and human effort, in particular as it should be applied to the preservation of our world. So to cycle back, man is placed on this world not for rights, but for duty. In one of his introductory chapters to the well-known Musar Sefer, Mesilas Yesharim, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato described Ma Chovas HaAdam Be'olamo. Ironically, he lived about 50 years before the American Revolution. 50 years before man transitioned into a world searching for and endlessly protecting rights, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato reminded us that we are placed here as mitzuve v'ose, as obligated creatures, driven to duty, called to mission, and the rights of man have to be protected in the service of that mission and to enable the proper dispensation and the proper prosecution of duty. And animals who don't possess duty don't possess rights. We're to be careful not to cause them inordinate pain. We're to be careful not to act irresponsibly towards nature, but to base these policies and these behavior upon animal rights seems to reflect a world whose perspective on rights has gone astray.